they joined us at the campfire those many millennia ago. Those wild animals sold their freedom for our care, protection, and provisions. That transaction leads us to ask, what did we get by domesticating wild animals?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,134th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Drummondville who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with Griffin Queener on the boards. Griffin is our flight plan, is our flight all pre-checked, and we're ready to take off?
Yeah, we're ready to go.
Ready to go. And producer Sarah Bell Lynn has filed the flight plan, so let's take off. Folks, way, way, way back in time, some wild animals began showing up at our campfire, and after sniffing around for a bit, asked if we would be so kind as to allow them to join us at the fire. After thinking about it for a while, we said, sure, come join us. And so a bargain was struck. The animals would give up their wildness for our care, provisions, and protection. In return, we would get companionship, food, labor, transportation, clothing, pest control, and so much more. But we had to earn all of that. The relationship that developed through that bargain has been managed through the process of selection. In the wild, selection was a natural process in which those fit enough to survive the elements were selected, those unfit passed into history. But in culture, which is us, the selector is the value placed on the animal by its human protector. What the human values is selected, and what is not valued is not selected. That bargain struck so long ago between we humans and our animals leads us to ask, why did animals and people decide to work with each other? How did cultural selection determine how animals and people would work together? And what does the future of our cultural selection portend for animals and us? Well, to help us hunt up some answers, we have Gavin Erringer, who is the author of Leaving the Wild. Gavin, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Michael. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to be here. Up there in Colorado, right?
Yep, in Denver.
Denver. Good. A front cowboy, as it were. So, and there you were. You were a cowboy, weren't you?
Yeah, I put myself through college, in fact, working on horse ranches and cattle ranches a long time ago, Michael.
Well, I was there myself a long time ago as well. But I don't think it ever leaves you. Do you think that?
No, honestly, my interactions with animals all my life, whether they be dogs or horses or cattle, have really influenced my entire career and my thinking, and that was sort of the genesis of Leaving the Wild.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we get to that epiphany, tell us a little bit about your writing. You write quite a bit about horses, correct?
Yeah, well, when I started off, I was mainly a horseman. My main interest was in training horses. So I started working for a magazine called Western Horseman, which in fact started in California in the 1930s.
Right.
And it was the foremost horse magazine in the world. And I was a young, ambitious writer, and I went down there and met their publisher, and he was the kind of guy, he was like Will Rogers. He never met a person he didn't like. He liked me, so he gave me a chance to start writing, and that led to a nearly two-decade-long relationship with that publication where I was a columnist and a feature writer.
Good.
So, yeah.
Well-versed in horses. And speaking of horses and epiphany moments, take us to that moment in at the Denver Stock Show when you were watching Buck Brannanan.
Sure. Well, right now, I mean, I don't know if people realize this, but Denver holds a major stock show, and it used to be the event that people came from all over the country to be at and to experience animals. And Buck Brannanan was a horse clinician. He's famous. He was the character that Robert Redford portrayed in The Horse Whisperer. And Buck was talking to the audience and training a horse, And he said at one point, these animals gave up their wild freedom in exchange for our care and protection. They give so much to us, and we owe them our understanding in return. And it was that idea of coming to the fire and leaving the wild and joining us willingly that sort of inspired the title and my thought process, really, on writing a book. So from that day forward, I kind of set off to gather as much knowledge and opinion and facts and stories as I could, and I worked on this project for nearly 5 years.
Wow. Now, you describe that experience of watching buck in an arena with a horse that had never been ridden or broken before. Kind of give us a little thumbnail of that, because that was a magical moment.
Well, it's all part of colt training or horse training. But we sort of transformed our ideas about how to go about training animals in a more natural way that took into consideration their emotional state, their body language, their way of interacting among themselves, and sort of interjected ourselves into that to create a training method. And Buck was just the master of that. He would almost mesmerize the animal with his actions. And in this case, he had a colt that was brought into the arena, and just by sort of applying a little bit of body language and know-how, he got that animal to trust him and eventually to let him put a saddle on it and ride it around the arena. And just to see this happening in real time is quite an experience, and really a metaphor for the idea that we're interacting with these animals and that we're both sort of gaining something in return. And that was the experience of seeing Buck at his clinic.
Well, and I wanted you to bring that up a little bit, because it's the theme, I guess, of today's program and your book is selection. And this interaction between animals and people in which we take charge by selecting animals for specific traits. You know, and in that process, we're kind of at a turning point, it seems to me. You know, in the old days when people broke horses, they literally broke horses and forced them to our will. But it seems like we're heading in almost in a different direction now with respect to our attitude toward animals. Am I wrong?
Well, I don't know that it's anything new, to be honest. I actually think the practice of breaking horses rapidly was more of a commercial solution in the Old West. You needed horses, and you needed them fast, and there were ways where you can force animals to your will. There's no question. But I think that, you know, one of my chapters in the book is about Mongolian horsemen.
Right.
And Mongolians are probably among the oldest horsemen in the world. And, you know, they live with horses every day. Horses are everything to them. And I've watched documentaries on them and seen their work. And, you know, honestly, they are very slow and deliberate in the process. And I think that we're actually regaining an idea that the old ways in some ways were maybe better and maybe more suited to the task. But you raise an interesting point, and I think this is the important distinction about my book. I was really concerned with the idea that the quality of an animal's life begins before it's ever born. That is to say, the breeding decisions that we make influence an animal's life. I mean, just to give you an example, if you were to take my dog, Onda, he's an Australian Shepherd, and he comes from this long, long line of working dogs, and he's very smart. He plays frisbee, and he competes in agility, and he does show stuff, and he rides a skateboard. And a dog like that, a dog that's pretty, and a dog that's smart, and a dog that's healthy, won't end up in a place like a shelter. So the care, well, and if he did, he wouldn't be there for more than a day. The care with which he was bred and the quality are part of the reason why we value a dog like that more than, say,
a village
dog or something.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's important to understand that there's good breeding and bad breeding. And good breeding usually results in good outcomes for animals, whereas bad breeding, well, it usually results in a diminished life and suffering for the animals. So the book is really a lot about the importance of conscientious.
Now, would you say the same thing about people? Well, hold that thought. We're going to have to take a quick break. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Okay. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're going to be talking about our relationship with animals, how we brought them in from the wild, how we domesticated them, how we bred them, and turned them to what they are today. We're going to start with dogs, and then maybe cats, and then cattle, and then horses. Oh my goodness, what fun we're going to have today. 831-479-1980. Do stay tuned.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. You can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, What's Eating What today is our relationship with the animals that we brought in from the wild and domesticated and turned them into our friends and our sources of food, our transportation, our clothing. Oh, so much they have given us, but we had to take them in under our wing, first of all, and domesticate them before we got to any place. So how did we bring those animals in from the wild? That's what we're going to talk about with Gavin Erringer, the author of Leaving the Wild. Gavin, let's start with dogs, because so many people know about dogs, but how on earth did we bring them in from the wild, and what is the theory behind that?
Well, there's actually a few theories, but I think that scientists are beginning to come around to some ideas that were first expressed by a professor and his wife named Raymond and Lorna Coppinger back about a decade and a half ago. But the idea was that we had taken the animals and plucked them from the wild, maybe rounded up some wolf pups and you know, made them into dogs, sort of Pinocchio-like. But Raymond had the idea that that really wasn't the way it worked. The way it worked was that we created a new niche when we started moving out of the wild ourselves and into villages. We created a new environment, and there were certain animals that were better suited to exploiting that new niche, that new environment, and the wolf was one of them. Wolves probably hung out around our camps, are not really our camps so much as our villages, and benefited from our garbage, the things that we threw away. They were able to eat there, and the animals that were the most tame were the most successful because they weren't chased away. They served a purpose in sort of being a trash service or a cleanup service, and over time, the ones that were the most tame started to become adapted to that new environment, and that led to physiological changes that result in the dog that we have today. Hmm. And that's sort of the model to an extent for many of our domesticated animals. It was probably also the case that the cat became domesticated because it could help with keeping vermin under control.
And, wait a minute. Are you sure cats are domesticated? I'm not so sure about that.
Well, that's another debate, but I mean, I would say so. I would say so mainly because they're adapted to the human niche. I mean, the wild cat is a very, not a physiologically different animal, but a a different animal from the domestic cat in that it's much more wild and not accepting of human intervention. And they live a very solitary life, wild cats, as opposed to cats, which, you know, can get along with other cats and humans. So
would that describe the difference between cats and dogs, is that cats are solitary critters and dogs tend to be pack animals?
Well, I think what they are is human animals. I mean, I think the big tell in the story is that the animals that were successful were the ones that were able to adapt to the human environment. And as we have become more prolific and we have populated the globe and taken over all of its environs, with few exceptions, these are the animals that have succeeded and come along with us.
Yeah, have been the willing ones then, right? You know,
the fortunate ones in some ways, yeah.
Yeah. Some time ago, we did a show on the food chain with anthropologist Pat Shipman. That was way back on food chain number 1022. Yeah. Are you familiar with her?
Yeah, Pat actually wrote a blurb for my cover of my book.
Oh, good. Well, then you are. But she had a theory that that dogs were the reason that humans supplanted Neanderthals. And she made the remark that in her physical anthropology of, you know, looking at bones and noticing the scraping marks and whatnot, she determined that dogs were there with the Homo sapiens and allowed them to make commercial hunts almost of the woolly mammoths because they would the dogs would protect their kills from other critters. And thus almost led to the ability of Homo sapiens to develop villages, whereas the Neanderthals went without dogs and disappeared.
Yeah, I'd have to be a little bit skeptical of that myself. I think my own conclusion is a little different. Pat is saying, if I read you correctly, that the dog came before the village, and I would say the village came before the dog.
Okay.
I think the distinction is important because we don't have a lot of evidence that dogs existed prior to people settling into villages. There's a few bones here, a few bones there, but they might be wolves, they might be dogs, we don't really know. They seem awful wolf-like, that's the bottom line.
Yes.
But once we get into villages, then we get a population of dogs.
Oh, the generic village dog, right?
Right. We get a dog that is clearly a dog that lives among humans in large numbers. So I think that the village happened and then the dog followed. So that kind of is the difference that maybe I have between how Pat sees things and how my research indicated to me it happened.
Okay. That would be a fun discussion for an evening around the campfire. let me take you to the village then. You know, the dogs came with the village, and then they became village dogs.
Yeah, well, that's one of the questions that you wanted to look at today was, you know, what happened to animals once they became domesticated? And the answer is they adapted to our world. I mean, the wolf grew smaller, its teeth grew smaller, brain size actually grew smaller because the demands of the village were much less than the demands of the wild. And the main thing was that it got along with us. That was the important change, is that the animal got along with humans. And so our dogs became a much more sort of, I would say, just a more friendly version of the wolf. And in fact, that's what we call them, the familiar dog or the family dog. That's the name that we gave it, and that indicates a wolf that is, you know, domesticated and part of the family. So those changes, this was the interesting thing, those changes, the more friendly aspect of the dog actually resulted in physiological changes to their body that we see in the dogs today. And the example that I use in the book is the village dog, which is the most popular breed, if you will, the worldwide. There are a lot of dogs in the world today that don't have breed characteristics. They're simply adapted to living among humans in villages. And those are the most common dogs. And we don't see many of them in North America.
You know, I had one once when I lived in San Diego. I had a a little dog who I'm sure escaped, you know, across the border from south of the border, because he looked like a combination of every dog that exists.
Right. Yeah, well, I've actually worked with my trained dogs, too, and I've worked with village dogs. Some people brought some dogs over from, I believe it was Taiwan. Anyway, they were Taiwanese mountain dogs, she called them, but they were just generic village dogs. And it was really neat. It was neat to work with a dog that you sort of knew was what a generic dog was. Just this was the dog that we probably lived with in villages for thousands of years before we started really stepping up selective breeding and creating dogs for specific purposes.
Right.
So the dogs today are, the breeds that we have today are all a result of sort of tailoring dogs to specific needs.
And I suspect, you know, when you think about it, the first selection process was to select from those dogs that were friendly and reject those dogs that would eat you.
Yeah, well, at that point they were still wolves. But, yeah, we selected out the more friendly wolves, and eventually that selection process of just choosing for tameness resulted in a cascade of physiological changes that resulted in the dog that we know.
Okay, so we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about how we took the village dog and turned it into a poodle and all kinds of other critters as well, because that's exactly what we've done through time, through history, and by looking at that selection process, we can have a very interesting look at us ourselves, because we are the ones that we're creating all of these interesting critters that we have today. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Gavin Erringer, the author of Leaving the Wild. That's exactly what we're doing by selecting what we want to select. Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, some time ago when I was a student down there in San Diego, I had an occasion to give a speech on racism. And so, for an example, I brought my dog, Mr. Underhill, to class. Mr. Underhill, I'm sure, snuck across the border from Mexico and looked as though he was the product of free-range breeding for thousands of years. He was, I guess, what Gavin Erringer would call a village dog. And so I used this dog I held him up and I said my essential assertion in this speech on racism was that there will always be racism until we all look like this dog, which is to say, a little bit of everything. But that was the way dogs looked. And then sometime along the line, people started saying, I want something different. And so they started breeding dogs, and thus we have all kinds of dogs today. Where did that process start, Gavin?
Yeah, so how do we get from the generic sort of village dog to a very specific type like Lady Gaga's French Bulldog?
Yes, exactly.
That's one of the questions I wanted to answer in the book, and I think it kind of it goes like this. If you look at each village had the different characteristics. It had different geography, it had different weather, it had different societal needs, and so the dogs that lived in these villages became adapted. For example, if you were in the desert, you might end up with a dog that was very slender and adapted to a very warm weather climate and chasing animals out, you know, in the open. Whereas up in the Arctic, you would end up with a very heavy coated dog that was suited to those conditions and that would be utilized, say, pulling sleds.
You call them land races, right?
Exactly. A land race is just the idea that this is an animal that through the process of natural selection and some sort of human criteria adapts to a different, you know, a particular niche. And so these animals became more and more differentiated over time. And around the time of the Egyptian Empire, the Egyptians started to gather land race dogs and really selectively breed them. And so if you need a dog, say, to herd, you might choose dogs with the best herding characteristics, or you might choose dogs for hunting, or you might choose dogs for pets. The small, tiny lap dogs probably were a development of simply people wanting a dog around that could sit in their lap. So we started to become more specific in our selection criteria, and that's when our own breeding preferences really kicked in. And that's sort of how you get from the generic dog to the village dog to the idea of dog breeds.
And there we go. So one of the fascinating things about reading Leaving the Wild was that in what we did to animals, it was really a kind of an interesting way of looking in the mirror, because they are a reflection of our intentions, which, of course, takes us to the pit bull.
Right.
And Michael Vick.
Right.
Why did we invent the pit bull?
Well, the pit bull was sort of a long line of dogs that were invented for war and for fighting. And that goes back probably even before the Egyptians to one of the people that invaded them were called the Hyksos. And the Hyksos were, and I'm not sure if I say the name right because I've only seen it in writing, but anyway, they were a warlike people, and they had dogs of war. And those dogs of war were very ferocious and became part of the sort of the ancient arsenal, if you will. And from there, the Romans developed their own dogs of war. They used them in gladiatorial combat. Eventually, those made their way to Britain, and they had their own dogs of fighting dogs. And from those fighting dogs, we got dogs that were used for entertainment and fighting, and hence that's where the pit bull came from. It was a dog that was used specifically to fight against other dogs in a pit. And
so
it's the genesis of that breed of dog.
But that would indicate then that Michael Vick, though we look down on him for his, you know, pit bull activities, his fighting dog activities, really doing what people have always been doing, I guess.
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that we condone it. I mean, obviously, there are activities that we have decided over time are societally unacceptable, and dog fighting is one of them. But that doesn't mean that there aren't people who continued to practice it even when it became illegal. I mean, at the turn of the century in America, it was legal in most states to fight dogs. It's only been in the 20th century that we turned away from that practice. And yet it still holds a fascination to some people who I consider to be very cruel. And I don't think that that's been a good thing for anybody. You know, it just seems to me to promote cruelty. But the pit bull has been a victim of that, to be honest. I mean, the dogs are vilified and at the same time beloved. And
well, that's an interesting observation, because we bred them to be mean and cruel and vicious and to be ferocious fighters. And yet we feel sorry for them and adopt them and have made them pets. I had a conversation with one of my favorite vets here a few days ago, as a matter of fact, and he was talking about his eldest daughter and her husband adopted a seven-year-old pit bull from the dog pound, or whatever they call them these days. And the vet was just really mad that she had done such a thing, and he asked her why, and she said, well, I felt sorry for him. And don't we feel sorry for pit bulls, but does that change your nature? Aren't they still ferocious and mean?
You know, it goes on a dog-by-dog basis. I'm a dog trainer, and honestly, a lot of my work involves working with pit bulls. And while they can be lovely and very friendly, a lot of them are dog-aggressive. And dog aggression is a problem, because obviously we don't want our pets attacking other people's pets. And we don't want them attacking livestock. And we don't want them attacking people. And yet that is part of the genetic background of that dog. And so controlling that requires some knowledge. And unfortunately, that knowledge is not universal. Our ability to train dogs to be controlled and to do their, you know, to be, I guess, good citizens is beyond the capacity of a lot of the people who actually own them. So I don't want to get too deep into this topic. I really hope people will read the book and give it an open mind, because quite honestly, I'm not a big fan of the breed. I'm worried that it has been harming people and other dogs. And that my message in the book is not that this is a bad breed or a bad dog. My message is you need to understand this breed And we need to breed less of them because, quite frankly, they fill up dog shelters all over the country, and it really is on the people who breed them. I don't think that this is something that is the fault of anybody except for the people who actually are putting them on the ground.
And well, what does that say, though, about us that we do that?
Well, you know, there's the people who create them and the people who bring them home. I don't have any fault with the people who bring them home with the good intentions and good hearts. I have a problem with the people who are putting out way too many of them and causing them to be such a sort of neglected breed of dog that needs homes.
Fair enough.
If we could get people to breed... Go ahead.
Just stop breeding. We're going to have to take a quick break. When we come back, got to talk about cats. A lot of cats in the world. A lot of cats. Millions and billions right back. Do stay tuned. This is The Food Chain with Gavin Erringer, author of Leaving the Wild, with you.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to KnoxGardenBox.com. That's K-N-O-X, GardenBox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale at Guam, 15 August 1945.
When word came through that the war had ended, everyone went wild. We made noise with whatever we could get our hands on. Sirens shrieked, bells rang, horns bellowed, sailors whooped and hollered. I was the wildest of all because when I first went in the Navy, I read you had to do everything you could to keep your head and nerves together so you could survive to the end. Well, I held myself together almost 4 years aboard that tin can, and I made it through to the end. Yes, I celebrated. I whooped and I hollered and I banged on metal. You bet I did. And I celebrated a bunch for all those guys that couldn't, too.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. talesfromatincan.com. If your family car runs out of gas or oil or water, its engine will fail. If your body runs out of essential mineral or vitamin or amino acid nutrients, it will grow weak and you will be left with aches, pains, and diseases. Some say you can get all 90 of the essential nutrients you need from foods you eat. Maybe, but if you eat foods from farmed-out soils or foods that have had the life processed out of them, you will deprive your body of some essential nutrients. You can get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs for less than a daily latte with a 90 for Life Healthy Start Pack. It's easy, it's delicious, and they are essential.
Get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs to grow strong and stay healthy with a 90 for Life Healthy Start Pack at NutrientsToGo.com. That's NutrientsToGo.com. Get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs for less than the cost of a daily latte at NutrientsToGo.com. That's NutrientsToGo.com.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Some say there are two kinds of people in the world: dog people and cat people. And I suppose pretty close to being the truth, but the question is, what makes a person a dog person and a person a cat person? Better ask Gavin Erringer, author of Leaving the Wild. What would you say, Gavin?
Boy, that's a big question. I don't know that I have an absolute answer to that. But I think that one of the things that we're finding is cats have become the most popular animal, supplanting the dog with that title, if you will, in the United States. And I think part of the reason is lifestyle. You know, the millennial generation in particular have chosen to be urban living, and they have very active lifestyles. And a cat just kind of fits that picture a lot better than a dog. There's a lot less, you know, day-to-day interaction that has to take place to take care of them. So I think that cats have really become popular, especially among millennials. And there's actually some interesting research in my book that backs that up.
So cats are kind of like the pet that you don't have to have.
Yeah, they're low care. You know, they're low maintenance, if you will.
Yeah. So there it is. But you're a dog guy, right?
I'm a dog guy. I have to say that I've been around cats all my life, and I enjoy cats. I don't own cats, but we had a lot of cats around our farm and stuff like that. Now, one thing that I found interesting, this is one of the coolest chapters in the book, in my opinion, is I discovered that after the Second World War, this one guy came home from the war and he invented kitty litter. And kitty litter became what really transformed our relationship with cats. They went from being outside animals to being inside animals. And it was that transformation that I think is at the basis for why the cat is so popular today. If we didn't have kitty litter, I don't know that cats would be the America's most popular animal today. So
don't think so.
And that just shows how human invention can change our relationship with animals, and that's also a big theme in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to cows. Now, one of the big questions in my life is, what's the difference between a cow and cattle? Cows and cattle.
No, there really isn't. Cattle is just sort of the generic word for you know, bovines. Mm-hmm. And so cattle can, you know, a cow probably... The important thing is that the cow is of a lot more importance to us historically because it gave milk, and milk was the source of cheese and yogurt and butter and all sorts of things. And then when the cow got too old, you butchered her and she was meat. But, I mean, I don't think that the beef cow was really a thing until pretty late in our own evolution, because it was just too valuable as a milk animal to just raise for meat.
Mm-hmm. So we probably butchered all of the boys and milked the girls. Couldn't butcher all the boys, but at least most of them.
Yeah, well, that's sort of one of the things that they used to indicate cattle domestication is, was there a large proportion of females to males? That kind of told you that the cow was no longer wild, but actually domesticated, because we valued cows more than we did.
And I guess if there's anything that really demonstrates intention and cultural selection, it would be cows, or especially the story of Toy Story, for example.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Well, what I talk about in the book is breeding. So breeding is really important. I mean, if you go to the National Western, people maybe don't understand why we have livestock shows. Well, the answer is, people bring animals together so they can be judged, and we are basically judging them on the traits that we want. And so that judging criteria is super important, because the animals that are judged to be have a high proportion of traits are the ones that go on to breed.
How was Toy Story judged?
Toy Story was a dairy cow. What happened in the dairy industry is that when we got FedEx and we got the internet, all of a sudden we were able to ship cattle genetics all over the world. And so the animals that were superior or judged superior became, you know, hot commodities. And Toy Story was a particularly good dairy bull, and he went on to sire more than 500,000 offspring in the world. And that is to say that his semen was shipped all over the world to awaiting cows so that they could produce high-producing offspring that were healthy and had all the characteristics that dairy farmers wanted. So he was just one example of what we call a super bull, an animal so desirable that people wanted his genetics. And yeah, that's the story of Toy Story. It's in the book, and I'm not telling it nearly as fascinating as it was written in the book, so I hope people will look for it. But
And we also featured that the story of Toy Story some time ago on the Food Chain. It was an incredible story, but talks about the intentions, you know, and it points to a possible downside in our intentions, in that when we get really focused on one thing and look for that one thing, we lose out on all the other things. And you start that story. Well, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the criteria for milk production has been greater and greater production. And one of the things I say in the book is that the output of a modern dairy cow, the energy that is required for her to produce milk on a daily basis, is equal to that of a Tour de France rider riding every single day. And it's wearing these cows down, and it's because we've put milk production as the highest priority for these animals. And they've just become absolutely behemoth cows that are used in modern dairy farming, particularly the Holstein cow, which is the most popular dairy cow in the world.
And when we get back, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, I'd like to talk about the downside, possible downside of this total focus on very specific traits that we look for.
Sure.
And the consequence of that, especially with respect to horses, because you are a horse guy, Gavin Erringer. And so we'll pick up horses when we get back. Do stay tuned, right back.
They say we spend $25 billion a year sweating it out at the gym. Sweat contains some of the essential nutrients your body needs to grow strong and stay healthy. If you sweat these nutrients out and fail to replace them, your body will begin breaking down. Some say you can get all 90 of the essential nutrients from the foods you eat. Maybe, but if you eat foods from farmed-out soils or foods that have had the life processed out of them, you will deprive your body of some essential nutrients. You can get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs for less than a daily latte with a 90 for Life Healthy Start Pack. It's easy, it's delicious, and they are essential.
Get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs to grow strong and stay healthy with a 90 for Life Healthy Start Pack at NutrientsToGo.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
My notion is that the apogee of American civilization was that of the Plains Indian after the horse showed up and before the paleface showed up. Think of the freedom, the great herds of buffalo to feed on, horses to carry you where you wanted to go, nothing to do but fight with the neighbors, steal their women and their horses. Life was pretty good. What do you think about that notion, Gavin?
Well, the horse actually arrived with the Spaniards. The Spaniards brought the horse back to the New World when they arrived here. And the horses were allowed to proliferate on the Great Plains, and it virtually transformed Native American life in the space of less than a century. So that lifestyle was actually a fairly new development in the lives of Native Americans. And I think it was transformative without doubt, just as the arrival of a horse into any culture was transformative.
And it gave us movement like we had never known before, and the ability to hunt like never before. Mm-hmm. But, and you know, we've been working on horses for a long time now, and now we've come up with, like, thoroughbreds, right? And our selective breeding has become so selective that we've developed these magnificent horses that can run like the wind but are very brittle.
Well, in my dad's generation 50 years ago, when he was a cowboy in Arizona, the horses weren't brittle. I mean, we had horses that were every bit as fast, but they were stronger. And part of that is how they're raised, but part of that is also the genetics. So I think the important takeaway from my book about horses is that we've concentrated the genetics. And there's nothing wrong with breeding to, say, a really popular sire, unless there are problems with that sire. And sometimes those problems don't reveal themselves for years, decades. And when they do, those genetic problems are often of devastating consequence to the animals themselves. So What has changed is that we didn't used to be able to breed one sire to 100, 200, 300 mares a year. Now we can do that. And that's largely the result of breeding technology and also our ability to ship things across the world virtually in a matter of days or even hours.
But that's true not just for horses, but for your dog as well.
For every animal, yeah. The ability to transfer genetics globally is rapidly diminishing the gene pool. And as we were talking about with Toy Story, the mere fact that one bull can sire 500,000 cows is significant. And that same thing happens in horses and it happens in dogs. And just as you know at Metro Farm, that this idea of creating just one super example of a domestic crop or a domestic animal has proven to be a double-edged sword. They can be incredibly productive. They can feed the world, or they can allow people to enjoy a particular type of animal and its benefits. But the downside of that is that we've had a lot of unforeseen and foreseeable consequences.
Well, what fun. And your book is fun, and it's an interesting read for anybody who likes animals. And who doesn't like animals? Everybody should like animals, because we've taken them in from the wild, and they have become our responsibility now. So may as well like them, because they're ours, and we own them, and they own us. Gavin Erringer, thank you so much for joining us. The book, Leaving the Wild, and we're leaving the air right now. Thanks you all for tuning in to The Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.